Limon Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. May Martinez. The Los Angeles District Attorney's race pits two Democrats with very different ideologies on criminal reform against each other head-on. The battle between challenger George Gascon and incumbent Jackie Lacey. We'll dive in so you'll be ready to vote on Election Day. Plus, within 10 years, Governor Gavin Newsom aims to conserve nearly a third of California's land and coastal water. We'll find out what that means ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. Coming up, Governor Gavin Newsom just announced that California will dedicate 30% of its land to conservation by 2030. It's all part of his plan to combat climate change. We're going to hear more on that just ahead. Plus, the report is in about why several areas of the state were hit with rolling blackouts back in August. Remember that? But today we're going to start with the election. Tonight, Vice President Mike Pence will debate Senator Kamala Harris at the University of Utah. Our coverage of that will start tonight at 6. But as we keep telling you, it's not just about the presidential ticket. There are a whole lot of important down-ballot races to be up on, just like the Los Angeles District Attorney seat. This hotly contested race for DA shaping up to be a referendum on criminal justice reform. In a year marked by massive police protests, incumbent Jackie Lacey is billing herself as a reasonable reformer. Challenger George Gascon says Lacey represents the past and that he is the face of change. KPCC's Frank Stoltz takes a look at a race being watched around the country.
The differences between George Gascon and Jackie Lacey are stark. Gascon is a rare breed, a one-time hard-charging LAPD cop who rose to assistant chief, then, after serving as chief in San Francisco, became the city's district attorney, a post he left last year after nearly 9 years. The 66-year-old Cuban-born Gascon says his thinking about the criminal justice system has evolved, and he supports moving money away from cops and prosecutors to social services.
I think it's important that we begin to have serious conversations around shifting public resources where they do the most good for the public.
Gascon supports Measure J on the November ballot, which would require the county to spend 10% of its discretionary budget on restorative justice programs and affordable housing. That could siphon tens of millions of dollars from the DA's more than $350 million budget. Jackie Lacey opposes Measure J.
Well, my answer is no, because we are responsibly spending our money. See, what people don't understand is when you cut, you roll back all the progress that has been made.
Lacey argues, for example, that she'd have to cut funding to her unit that reviews potential wrongful convictions. The unit has cleared 4 people in 5 years. She staunchly opposes shrinking the LAPD or sheriff's budgets, too, warning public safety would suffer. The 62-year-old Lacey is seeking her third 4-year term, running the largest local prosecutor's office in the nation. She has spent more than 30 years with the office and enjoys widespread support in LA's law enforcement community, including the union that represents frontline prosecutors. Her traditional view of law enforcement has drawn the ire of some.
Prosecute killer cops!
Prosecute killer cops!
Jackie Lacey must be stopped!
Every Wednesday for the past 4 years, Black Lives Matter has protested outside Lacey's office, denouncing her refusal to press charges against all but one police officer involved in a fatal shooting during her tenure. The 2015 LAPD killing of Brandon Glenn in Venice stirs particular anger. Officer Clifford Proctor and his partner were trying to arrest Glenn for allegedly fighting with a doorman at a bar. Proctor shot the unarmed black homeless man twice in the back. Lacey cited Proctor's account that Glenn was going for his partner's gun.
We believe that Officer Proctor felt that he was reaching around for his firearm, and that's when he was shot.
In a highly unusual move, Gascon has promised to reconsider filing charges against Proctor. He wants to reconsider charges in 3 other closed cases, too. He argues Lacey is too deferential to cops who shoot.
She takes the theory of the shooting officer as presented by the officer and their lawyers and ignores all the evidence that points in the other direction.
Lacey calls Gascon's promise a dangerous political stunt that would erode the integrity of an office that's already made its decision. She also points out he failed to prosecute one officer in a shooting in San Francisco. Gascon says no shooting of an unarmed man occurred under his watch. On issue after issue, the two disagree. Lacey supports the death penalty. Gascon opposes it. Lacey opposed legalizing marijuana. Gascon supported it. And Lacey opposed the historic voter-approved Proposition 47, which in 2014 lowered certain drug and theft felonies to misdemeanors. Gascon co-authored the measure, which one study found narrowed the longstanding problem of racial disparities in arrests and sentencing. As DA in San Francisco, Gascon touts piloting an artificial intelligence tool to eliminate race-based decisions in early criminal charging, something he wants to try here. Gascon has become the darling of criminal justice reformers around the country, drawing millions in contributions from people like George Soros and a commercial voiced by none other than singer John Legend.
Our district attorney has done nothing about police brutality, and the police unions are thanking her by spending millions to keep her in office.
Lacey says she has held cops accountable, prosecuting more than 200 for excessive force, lying, workers' comp fraud, and other offenses. But it's true, unions representing LAPD officers, sheriff's deputies, Long Beach cops, and others are spending big bucks on the campaign, as much because they loathe Gascon as they like Lacey, which they do. They see Gascon as a turncoat cop who is now soft on crime. They point to a surge in car break-ins in San Francisco during his tenure. One year saw a 24% increase. Gascon says it was the police department that wasn't doing its job. One LAPD union ad seeks to portray Gascon as a carpetbagger from the north.
Now George Gascon is running for DA in LA. The con is on with George Gascon. Don't let him get away with it.
Miriam Krinsky is with the nonpartisan group Fair and Just Prosecution. She says after decades of focusing solely on police, the reform spotlight is on the prosecutors who act as gatekeepers for the black and brown men who flood the criminal justice system.
You know, they decide if charges will be filed, when charges will be filed, and what charges will be filed. They are huge factors in terms of systemic reform.
In February of 2019, Lacey may have taken her most important step toward reform.
Today, I'm proud to announce the establishment of the Mental Health Division within the DA's office.
It was one of the first of its kind in the nation. That division and previous similar efforts in her office have helped divert thousands of mentally ill and homeless people from jail. But a RAND study found it was a fraction of the number who could be diverted. Lacey says it's not her fault.
Diversion has been slowed not because the DA isn't willing to do it. It's because we need safe places to divert people to.
Lacey says she's lobbying county officials for resources like housing and community health care. When she was first elected in 2012, Lacey became the first woman and the first African-American DA in Los Angeles. Some in law enforcement were suspicious at the time, assuming she would be too liberal. Instead, she became one of their biggest supporters and a disappointment to reformers. But while reform is in the air this year, Gascon faces an uphill battle, says Fernando Guerra of the Center for the Study of Los Angeles.
It's very difficult to beat an incumbent, and especially one who's a Democrat in a heavily Democratic city, who is a woman who is African-American.
While Lacey has the support of several prominent Democrats, Gascon was endorsed by the LA County Democratic Party. And he says Lacey's race and gender should mean nothing in the race.
Jackie Lacey, but for the color of her skin, her gender, she has been horrendous to the African-American community.
Lacey bristles at a comment like that.
Look, I'm an African-American woman from the Crenshaw District. I have experienced racism firsthand, more so than anybody who wants to criticize me who isn't black.
While the issue of race has become intensely personal in this contest, Guerra says if you pull the lens back, it's hard to overstate what this election may mean to the still nascent criminal justice reform movement.
It will either give tremendous momentum to this movement, or it will pause the movement for a while and it has to reorganize and see what it's going to do next.
This race is not about law and order, says Guerra. It's about how best to make what many consider an unjust system fair. Covering criminal justice, I'm Frank Stoltz.
Jackie Lacey will debate George Gascon tomorrow night at 6:30. It'll live stream, and you can find that at laist.com. That's laist.com. All right, moving on now. A little more than an hour ago, Governor Gavin Newsom announced California will dedicate 30% of its land in coastal waters to conservation efforts by 2030. Here he is making that announcement.
We get so consumed, as we should, by energy and industry, commercial and residential side of this equation, and we forget our working lands. We forget our natural lands. We forget about species.
It's all a part of the state's ambitious goals to combat climate change. That includes recent plans for all new cars and trucks sold in-state to be zero-emission vehicles by 2035, and for us to be using 100% climate-friendly energy statewide by 2045. Now, this news follows a report out Tuesday about why many parts of the state were hit with rolling blackouts in August, the first in 20 years. Over the summer, Governor Gavin Newsom had demanded the state's agencies explain what went wrong, and now three of those agencies have released a self-evaluation on the root cause of the outages. Sammy Roth, staff writer for the LA Times, has been covering this. Now, Sammy, let's start with the power outages. Take us back to that heat wave in August. What was the situation like, and how many people did those rolling outages affect?
Yeah, you know, we've had a bunch of heat waves since then, so I guess people might have forgotten some of the details of this one in particular. This was the one where it hit 130 in Death Valley. We had four of the five hottest August days that the California's had in the last 35 years. And it was hot all over the western United States, so it was pretty bad. These rolling outages, the first one was on August the 14th in the evening. That was a Friday night. You had, I think, about half a million homes and businesses that time that lost power for as long as 2.5 hours. And then the next night as well, on the Saturday evening, you had another 300,000 utility customers that also lost power for up to an hour and a half.
So remind us of what the agencies are that are involved in keeping our lights on.
Yeah, so this being California, there are a bunch of agencies kind of all doing different facets of the same thing. So we've got the Energy Commission, the Independent System Operator, and the Public Utilities Commission all worked on this report.
All right, so they've released this report on the cause of the blackouts. What did they find?
So basically three things, and they sort of faulted themselves for not being prepared in a bunch of different ways. One had to do with climate change, the fact that obviously the world is getting hotter, we're having more extreme heat waves, and they found that the way that we're planning to, you know, have reliable energy supplies in California and to make sure we have enough power on hand is not adequately taking into account these hotter heat waves. They also found that we didn't line up the right kinds of power sources in particular to have in the evening to replace all of the solar when the solar power goes offline after sundown. And then they also said that these sort of complicated market mechanisms that we have in place that are supposed to, I mean, generally they're supposed to keep electricity prices low and steady, but they said that some of them may have masked the problems that we were seeing here and stopped them from preparing, right?
Why didn't they know about this, Sammy? I mean, we trust these agencies to be able to be ahead of these things. And we've known about climate change for a long time. I mean, we just mentioned how Death Valley in that weekend was 130 degrees. So why was California caught unprepared for this heat storm?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, it's something that's been, you know, they've been discussing this for a while. The Independent System Operator, which oversees the energy markets for the state, started warning about a year ago. It was September of 2019. They came out and they said, hey, you know, this is a problem. We don't have the right energy sources lined up. We're going to be unprepared for a situation like this. But even then, they said that they thought it wouldn't be that big a problem until next summer. And everyone was a little caught off guard that we started to see the problem right now.
Sammy, is it good that they at least pointed the finger at themselves and said, hey, my bad?
Well, I mean, I think it depends what happens next. I mean, they have a lot of recommendations here for things that they all ought to do better and ways that they want to work with the, you know, the utilities and the other, you know, government-run energy providers across the state to do this right. I think we've got to wait and see if they do those things.
We're talking to Sammy Roth, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Now, California, we mentioned before, has some pretty ambitious plans to phase out fossil fuels in the years ahead and move on to a climate-friendly energy. Sammy, how did those plans affect the state's preparation for heat waves like the ones we experienced?
Yeah, so this is really a key part of it. California is transitioning to this system where we're going to have less power and ultimately no power, or very little power from these fossil fuel plants, gas plants and coal plants that you can turn on and turn off whenever you need the power, and a lot more power from solar and wind farms, which of course are sort of more subject to the vagaries of the sun and the wind. So this is something that we really need to solve. Part of what's happening now is that we have retired some gas plants. They've been shutting down. And there's a question of, what's going to take their place to sort of fire up in the evening hours when the sun goes offline. That's one of the areas where the agency says that we haven't prepared right. And this is only going to, sort of be a more and more of a challenge as we continue moving in that direction. Doesn't mean it can't be done, but it's going to take work.
Now, we've been talking about the state agencies. All. What about the other side of this, the energy providers and power plant operators?
Yeah, one of the really interesting findings in this report that came out yesterday was that, during these evenings when we were having these power shortages, power plants in California were still exporting somewhat significant amounts of power across state lines to utilities in other states. And it seems that part of the reason for that is that energy providers within California had sort of underestimated or underscheduled how much electricity demand they were going to have, which allowed these power plants to then go and basically make deals to sell out of state. Not totally clear yet why that happened, but it's pretty weird that this was going on.
You know, Sammy, I can't help but imagine California on October 7th, 2050. So go with me here, Sammy, on this little trip here. It'll probably be 100 degrees. There's going to be more than a handful of wildfires burning somewhere. And if Governor Newsom's recent executive orders work out as he hopes they will, there's going to be thousands of electric cars and trucks plugged in, soaking up all that power. In addition, Sammy, to air conditioning and pretty much everything else we already plug in. So if we're having blackouts now, what is Newsom's plan for that future?
Oh, that's such a good question. I frankly don't know that Governor Newsom at this point, has that plan that's going to make things perfectly okay in 2050. But you're right. I mean, society is already very dependent on the electric grid, and the way things are going with transportation, especially, we're going to become more and more dependent on the electric grid, even as the world gets hotter. So, it's definitely something that if this is all going to come together, is going to require a lot of investment in, the infrastructure, in the power lines, in the distribution lines, in getting, more clean energy generating facilities, big and small, on our rooftops and out in the desert, in all likelihood built to meet that demand. Definitely not going to be easy, not guaranteed to happen.
That's Sammy Roth, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, where he's been reporting on the cause of California's rolling blackout. Sammy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, 7 months into the pandemic, it still feels as if we're learning new things about COVID each and every week. So that, of course, leads to new questions, such as, can the coronavirus really stay on your skin for 9 hours? So many of those kinds of questions still exist because, as I said, we're all still kind of learning as we go. Now, for all of your questions, we have an expert with all the answers. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. Today in Los Angeles County, indoor shopping malls have reopened for business at a limited percent capacity. And yesterday, the waiver program began accepting applications from schools that hope to get students back in the classroom sooner rather than later. But with LA still averaging about 700 to 800 new cases a day, it's clear that the coronavirus is still very much a threat here. Incidentally, it was announced this morning that a member of Governor Gavin Newsom's office staff tested positive for the virus. And on the national level, we found out yesterday that White House aide Stephen Miller has contracted it too. One of at least half a dozen people in the president's circle to test positive in the last week. So with all of this going on, we thought it'd be a good idea to check in with one of our medical experts. Dr. Richard Jackson is a professor emeritus at UCLA and a former public health officer in the state. Dr. Jackson, first let's start with the White House. The president announced last Thursday night that he had COVID-19 and was released from the hospital this past Monday, returning with much fanfare. There has been both criticism and applause for the president's actions, but let's stick with some facts. If you have been diagnosed, doctor, with COVID, how long is someone contagious and still a risk to other people?
You know, he probably had the virus for 3 or 4 days before he really was showing symptoms, which meant he probably had it during the debate.
During the debate, yeah.
Once the symptoms appear, and he probably was spreading it for the day or two before he had symptoms, they can last up to 10 days, and he can be infectious that whole time. And in fact, if he had any kind of underlying immune problem, which, by the way, dexamethasone can cause that, he can be infectious for up to 20 days. So this is not something to be casual about. He got, I think, lots of care, but I would be very careful about going out and mixing up with people for a while.
Yeah, so it's still a big window where he is a threat to others, but also a threat to himself in a way, right?
You know, this is kind of a crazy virus. You know, when someone has the flu, and one of my pet peeves with a pediatrician as well is when someone said, "Oh, I had the flu." I said, "Well, did you feel like you were hit by a truck?" And say, "Oh, no, I just, you know, I had a runny nose." Well, that's
it happens all the time. Everyone says that, doctor.
Yep. And when you have the flu, you don't even want to get out of bed. Your head hurts. Everything hurts. And COVID's worse. And, you know, our death rate with regular flu is about 1 in 10,000 under the age of 60. And up over age 60, it's about 1 in 1,000. But the death rate for COVID is much higher than that. So this is not anything to be casual about. And I know he did a tweet saying that flu is worse than COVID. Yeah. That's wrong. That's flat out wrong.
Yeah. And again, doctor, a reminder, if someone does have the virus, even if they are not outwardly ill, what is the best course of action?
You know, you probably don't know you have the virus unless you go get tested. But once you've been tested and you're told you have it, you have to wear a mask. You have to stay in. You've got to wash up. And you ought to keep your distance. 6 feet is a minimum, really. More than that, I suppose if you stand on a balcony 100 yards away from anybody else, it's okay. But stay away from people and wear a mask and make sure they do, too.
So all the same basics, though, right? I mean, it's funny. These rules don't change. At least the basic rules, doctor, don't seem to change. But it's funny how we always come to a point where we're still asking the same questions.
Well, you know, people are tired of this. They want it to be over. 7 months of isolation and the rest. And I think, as I was thinking about schools, some of this is, I think in some ways, local is going to be better. People looking at their own situation, using their best judgment, their best information, and deciding what to do. And we'll talk maybe a little more about that later if you want.
Yeah. And you mentioned how the president suggested that the coronavirus was less deadly than the flu. Facebook took down that post. What can you tell us about the effects of the coronavirus versus the flu, though?
You know, the flu, as we described, but coronavirus, you have all those symptoms I just mentioned, but they seem to be worse and they seem to last longer. And the invasion of one's lungs, and if you see the ongoing CT scan and early in the course where the lungs just continue to fill up with inflammation, fluid, pus, and other things, and it also can affect the liver, it can affect the brain, and you know, the so-called long haulers, the folks that have had it for a long time, just feel disabled for months at a time. You can get that with flu, I suppose, but it's rare compared to what we're expecting with this one.
Yeah, no one would confuse the two. I mean, no one that's had both would confuse the two going forward.
I think that's right.
Okay. About its contagion level, we now know that we wouldn't need to worry too much about the virus living on surfaces, but wondering about human skin, doctor, does it linger if you don't, say, use some soap and water or at least something to wash your hands or skin?
You know, I saw this study where it was done in a laboratory and they were using cadaver skin.
Yeah.
And skin from a cadaver is sometimes used for transplants and other such things. And the virus lasted longer in the laboratory on cadaver skin. Well, that's probably not surprising. But I think it goes right back to if you shake hands with someone that just has COVID and they just sneezed into their hand before the handshake,
oof,
you damn well better go wash your hands fast. And soap and water works very well. And if you need the antiseptic, that's fine. But soap and water is the best of all.
Talking to Dr. Richard Jackson of UCLA. Now, we mentioned how the president went back to the White House with a lot of fanfare, very theatrical. He took off his mask to wave to crowds from the balcony. And the White House said he was not near anyone when he did that. But remind us again, Doctor, why masks are such an essential tool for combating the virus.
You know, if you had the virus in your nasopharynx, your upper airways, and it would probably reduce the amount of virus getting out of you to other people by maybe 85% or so. If someone else 6 foot is a distance and they're wearing a mask, they're reducing the amount by about the same amount. And the amount of virus that goes over distance goes down with the square of the distance. So if you're 1 foot away from the person, well, let me rephrase that. If you're 6 feet away, it's 36 times less that you're getting. So the distance really helps. And as all Los Angelinos know, if you're out in the sun, that's even better in terms of distance.
Now, doctor, over the past 7 months, I'll admit I have been militant about wearing a mask. I've calmed down a lot, though, in the last few months about confronting people that don't, because I want to live. This is a big city. People get angry all the time. But one of the things I've heard in person, I've heard people say about why they don't wear a mask is, and I wish I had a dime for every time I've heard this, but I'd hear this. It's bad to breathe your own carbon dioxide. So does wearing a mask, doctor, hamper oxygen flow or pose any kind of hazard to someone's lungs?
That's a funny question. I hadn't thought of breathing your own. Of course, we do it all the time because we have residual carbon dioxide in our airways because we never can get it all out in one breath. So no, that's not a threat. You wouldn't want to be in a locked room or the old movies about being locked in a safe because you'll use up your oxygen and get toxic with the CO2. But believe me, it moves very rapidly through a cloth mask or even a paper mask. It's not a problem. And there was a small study that looked at this, even with relatively frail veterans, VA patients, and they didn't show any decline in their oxygen levels wearing the mask versus not wearing the masks.
You should have heard them, doctor. It was like they were testifying to Congress. They were that resolute that it was bad to breathe in your own carbon dioxide in a mask. It was kind of wild. Now, all right, let's...
Well, I'm going to use that as an argument against global warming. That's good.
Well, you are a doctor. You don't want to ruin your standing in the medical community, doctor. I don't think you want to do that. Let's talk about contact tracing now. We saw it happen in real time last week as we tracked the spread of the virus among folks at the White House. Now the effort has now begun in the governor's office because, as I mentioned, one of his staffers has tested positive. We're going to be following reports of any new cases out of Newsom's circle. But my question is, how robust is contact tracing right now in the state? How is it helping us track COVID-19 cases, and how isn't it?
You can do contact tracing. Well, it's been around for years. We used it with multi-drug resistant TB. We use it with syphilis. We use it with other things. If the party in the outside the White House last week had perhaps 150 people, you probably could track all the contacts for those folks as well. Once you start getting up to numbers in the millions, it's very, very difficult. So, I think in some ways opting for prevention rather than thinking it's going to fix. By the way, CDC should be involved in the contact tracing in that White House get-together because they're very good at this.
You said they should be involved.
They should be. Apparently excluded up until now.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Also mentioned about waivers that are being accepted in LA County for schools that wish to reopen. What do you think? What are your thoughts about how schools should move forward here?
you know, the old saying about all politics is local. I think all openings ought to be local in some ways as well. Mm-hmm. And when you have really smart administrators, really smart teachers who are engaged in this, and parents and students that want this to work. I know of a school up near Antelope Valley where the students were involved in planning out their own graduation 6 feet apart, no contacts, no parties, no even parents at the thing. It was all done by video. And it worked very, very well. And I think in some ways excluding people from this decision process is a mistake. And so I think we're going to have to reopen, but slowly, carefully, and we're going to find where it doesn't work and have to back off in those situations.
One more thing, Doctor, one more thing. The vaccine. Food and Drug Administration released a tighter guidelines on Tuesday for coronavirus vaccine developers. Given this, what's your sense of when we might start to see something viable, something, anything?
Producing a vaccine that you're going to give to hundreds of millions of people is an extraordinarily serious responsibility. And I am glad that FDA is being very careful and very stringent. Vaccines are wonderful. I've seen children die of all the vaccine-preventable diseases before we had vaccines. We need them, but we want to make sure they're really functional. So that's my long way of saying I don't think we're going to see them at large-scale availability until spring.
All right, that's Dr. Richard Jackson of UCLA. Doctor, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Can Meryl Streep sing? I know that for most of you out there, there is nothing Meryl Streep can't do. I mean, leap tall buildings in a single bound, more powerful than a locomotive. But can Meryl Streep really sing? I mean, she's done it before in movies, and she's about to do it again. Find out all about it when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, and you can get the Take 2 podcast on Apple Podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. Movie theaters vow to stay open after Regal announces closures. A commission led by Anita Hill analyzes gender and racial bias in Hollywood. And what do Meryl Streep, Keegan-Michael Key, and Kerry Washington have in common? Hint, it involves singing and dancing. It's time to go on the lot.
Your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Joining us, as always, Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. Now, Rebecca, let's start with the happy news. This morning, you posted a story about the movie musical The Prom, which is based on a Broadway musical. Tell us all about the plot, and then we'll get to know how it managed to finish production during the pandemic, because that's part of this big story. So tell us what's it about.
In The Prom, Meryl Streep, Nicole Kidman, James Corden, and Andrew Rannells play Broadway actors whose careers are in a slump, and they decide to find a social justice cause to boost their images. They end up going to Indiana to champion a young woman who's been banned from taking her girlfriend to the prom. It starts out as sort of a satire about celebrity activism and then ends up having a kind of heartfelt message about inclusion.
Is that already, I mean, I'm sold already, Rebecca, just hearing that first part, knowing that Meryl Streep's a part of it. So you were actually on the set of this film in early March. What was going on in the production at the time, and what happened next when the lockdown actually happened?
Yeah, this is the last set I was on before the world shut down. I was there on March 6th, and they were shooting the big finale song and dance number in the gym at the Helen Bernstein High School in L.A. For a lot of reasons, this feels like a kind of environment Hollywood won't see again for quite some time due to COVID. There were about 300 extras and dancers in formal wear singing and dancing alongside, you know, Marilyn, Nicole, and James, and everybody was breathing and touching and doing things which we now will not likely see on a film set. The film had to shut down with just 3 days left to go.
Oh, wow.
They ended up picking back up in July with a lot of PPE and a very small cast and crew and getting it done.
Rebecca, considering, you know, the part of your job is to go on sets all the time, do you miss it? Because, I mean, that was the last time. It has been a long time.
I do miss it. I just was on one this week and had to get a COVID test to go, but was very happy to be there and to see everybody masked up following social distancing and to see that production is continuing here in LA.
So what are the release plans for the prom?
Well, so this movie will be in select theaters in December ahead of its release on Netflix December 11th. Also, any movie where Meryl Streep sings and dances, I think you can expect to be present in the awards race in some way. So I think you'll be hearing a lot about it.
So one thing before we move on, did you hear Meryl sing?
Well, the day I was on set, the group were lip syncing to the track they had already recorded, but she sounds terrific in the film. She's really belting. Her role is this Broadway diva who's a real belter, and she went for it and did, singing and dancing lessons before the production started. So she was really into it.
So it doesn't matter if she's any good at it. I mean, it's Meryl Streep being a Broadway diva in a musical comedy. That's
And she's
enough.
Good at it. I will say, annoyingly enough, she's good at that too.
Perfect. All right. I know. Speaking of movie theaters, in the wake of the announcement that Regal is planning to close 500-plus theaters in the U.S. tomorrow, other theater chains are starting to speak out. So what's the latest in that part of the biz?
Yeah, a couple of the other chains are vowing to stay open despite the very challenging business environment. AMC, which is the largest chain in the world, is crediting a deal it signed with Universal for its ability to stay open. It's interesting because this deal, which we've talked about on the show, was kind of controversial at the time it was signed just a few months ago. Historically, theater chains have really resisted studios wanting to shrink that window of time between when a movie is in theaters and when it's available at home. But AMC and Universal made this deal where the theater chain gets a portion of the revenue Universal earns when its movies become available on demand. So in an era when revenue is barely trickling into theaters, this compromise kind of potentially provides a bit of a lifeline for AMC.
You know how I've been so resolute about not going to the movies because I don't trust it. But now when I think about it, when I am ready to go back, what if there's no theaters to go back to?
Right. Yeah. It's a really, really tricky time in that business. And I think folks are hoping that the theaters can make it through the next few months and be there when it's safe to go.
Talking to Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Now, COVID isn't just damaging the movie biz. There are also some TV shows that are not returning because of it. One is Glow. Now, if Netflix, Rebecca, could figure out a way for Ryan Murphy to finish shooting The Prom, how come they couldn't bring back Glow?
Well, The Prom only had a few days left to shoot with two cast members. Glow had just shot one episode of its fourth season when the pandemic hit, and Netflix is citing the cost of making a, quote, physically intimate show with its large ensemble cast. I mean, one thing we're learning with these first productions that have gotten up and running is that it's extraordinarily expensive to COVID test a big cast and crew every day. Maybe if it's a big Jurassic World sequel that a studio is expecting to make $1 billion on, it's worth it. If it's the fourth season of a TV show with a moderate-sized audience, the math may not add up.
So it's such an LA story. I wonder if they ever thought about maybe shooting it somewhere else where the infection rate wasn't as high.
I mean, possibly. I know if actors and crew people quarantining right now all over the world for shoots in Canada, Germany, Australia. But even in those places where the infection rates are low, you still have to do the testing, provide the PPE, pay a COVID monitor, and it just gets really costly really quickly.
All right. Finally, one more thing. The Hollywood Commission on Eliminating Sexual Harassment and Advancing Equality has released two reports so far this month. Today is about gender and racial bias in the industry. Rebecca, what are the findings?
Yeah, this is the commission that Anita Hill is heading up, and the report revealed a perhaps not too surprising perception gap in Hollywood. There are wide differences in how people perceive bias between men and women and other represented groups. Women were about twice as likely as their male colleagues to say they had experienced bias. Women of color cited even higher rates of bias than their white counterparts. The group that has the most positive view of progress the industry has made on the issue of diversity is white men. 78% think it's going great. 67% of black men have a positive view. White women, 66%. Black women, 47%. So clearly people are seeing this moment very differently based on their personal experiences.
How are they going about doing these reports, compiling them?
Well, they're surveying a large group of people in the industry. This has been underway. It was part of sort of an initiative that was launched immediately after the Harvey Weinstein stories broke in the fall of, 3 years ago now, 2017. So it's been a long time coming. And there was sort of a flood of well-intended research and programs launched at that time. This is one among many.
One more thing on this. I know having Anita Hill run this is meaningful, but I'm wondering on a practical level, Rebecca, how can these reports really do enough to change things? I mean, we keep hearing report after report, but things seem to stay the same.
Yeah, I mean, this is the challenge. You do have to study this stuff in order to properly address it, but it does start to feel kind of like white noise. Could the money being spent on this study just be spent to create another job in Hollywood for another woman and person of color, thereby making a workplace more inclusive? I mean, I think this is the question people are starting to ask themselves. More studies, more panels, or just more jobs?
That's Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ay.
All right, any podcast project that hopes to grow and thrive needs a lot of things going its way. Time, patience, really good people working on it, a little bit of luck. But in most cases, the most important thing is financial backing. I mean, it's typically how these things happen. It's typically how they're done. But if there's no cash, sometimes there's no podcast product. Except in one case. We're going to find out about that case when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and online at kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. In February of 2019, when Spotify announced it was buying the New York-based podcast company Gimlet for $200 million, it was clear that pods had become a huge business. That company, co-founded by Alex Blumberg, formerly of This American Life, launched with a podcast about how he was creating a podcast company. How's that for meta? But years earlier on the West Coast, another podcaster took a very different approach to funding his work and growing his business. That guy is Roman Mars, host and producer of 99% Invisible.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
This week on his LA studio show, Servant of Pod, Nick Kwa talks about Mars, and Nick is here. All right, so Nick, let's start with 99% Invisible. That could be a podcast about me in high school, 99% Invisible. So tell me why you wanted to profile him.
Well, for folks who aren't familiar with 99% Invisible, the shorthand is that it's about architecture, design, hidden world of everyday things. But the longhand is that it's really about all this sort of ideas, thinking, and history that goes into structures and physical objects. It's very, you know, small things, big ideas kind of podcast.
If you've listened to the show for a while, you know that we're big fans of icons and symbols and signage. And one of the main places you encounter those is on the road. So in our ongoing ubiquitous icon series, we're taken to the highways.
I'm thinking we should call this one Highways 101. You know,
I like it.
And I wanted to talk with Roman for a bunch of reasons. His show just turned a decade old last month.
Wow.
And so it felt like a good time to talk about his legacy. But the other news hook is that he's publishing a book version of the podcast that comes out this week.
All right. So let's go back to 2010-ish, right around there when 99% Invisible first came on the scene. What did the podcast industry look like back then? And what was Roman envisioning for the show?
Podcasting was essentially a digital backwater, like, you know, not completely. There were a couple of companies here and there trying to figure out how to make money off it and build shows and whatever. But for the most part, it was just, you know, basically the prairies. Most podcasts back then felt more like side projects than anything else, or, you know, like NPR and WNYC was already sort of just republishing radio shows as podcasts. And there weren't very many people making a full-time living off of making podcasts. And so back then, Roman had originally started the show as a, you know, as a segment on the radio, but it also happened to be the case that he released it as a podcast simply because he could.
I kind of had no imagination for how it would end up, because this is not how I thought
podcasting would necessarily go. All I know is, like, I knew that we were making something that people really, really liked. And whenever you're doing that, that's meaningful, like either monetarily or just emotionally. And I knew for a long time, when I thought the show was undervalued or podcasting was undervalued or even public radio programs were undervalued by the system, I always knew I was going to be kind of independent because I just was, you know, I just wanted to solve the problem myself. And every time I had to ask permission, I never got permission.
All right, Nick, Roman mentions the system. So what system is he talking about when he says that podcast and public radio programming was undervalued?
I mean, basically the man, right?
Yeah.
Like, right, 90s Gen X-y capitalism, basically. Yeah, so specifically, I mean, I guess he was talking about markets, right? Like podcast advertising at the time was still pretty like nascent. And he also had a sense then, and you know, I think he would argue now, that public radio programming isn't really tapping into the money that it could make if it leaned harder into certain things like, you know, direct show fundraising or other forms of monetization. Obviously, there's like a lot of complications with public radio specifically, and not to be too meta about it. I don't want to cause any sort of uprising here, but there are ways in which you can say like certain shows could be making more money if it did certain things. And that was something that he was thinking about at the time.
So, Nick, what was Roman's approach to growing and funding 99% Invisible?
So I think to answer that question, it's important to sort of build a contrast. Like these days, podcast folks can get deals and contracts with publishers. They can launch shows knowing that they can build like subscription membership stuff into the business. But back then, it was all like, can you scrabble together a couple of advertising contracts here and there? And part of Roman's work at the time was trying to figure out other ways that he could do this on the fly, as he talks about in this clip.
So in the beginning, what really got me going was telling the short little stories and having fun with them and developing a tone and a way to interact with the audience, which was really fun. And then what really took over was solving the problem of making a thing when there was no industry to make a thing. You know, like there was no... And I was really into the business of it. And for a while, I was totally fascinated by the Kickstarter campaigns and the ad sales and developing all that stuff so to make sure that people who I admired, the people who worked for me, could make the thing they want to make and be secure and feel good.
I want to say like the notion of building a full staff is like for a podcast, it was very rare back then. And it's a little bit more common these days and it still feels pretty novel. And I should say that he wasn't the only podcaster who was trying to figure that stuff out at the time. But he was definitely the one that got a ton of attention from a quote-unquote mainstream perspective. Like, he launched a pretty successful Kickstarter campaign back then, 2013, 2014, that funded his show and created something called Radiotopia, which is a podcast collective he helped launch in 2014.
So how did the success of 99% Invisible impact the larger podcast industry, you think?
99PI is by no means alone in proving that podcasting could be a business. But it's definitely one that inspired like a lot of people to kind of look at it and go like, oh, you could actually like make a living out of this thing. That's incredible. I want to try to do that. And these days, it also stands out as being one of the few big independent shows, which, you know, kind of leads into this whole other thing about podcasting becoming a bigger corporatized business. And that for some reason or another, it's partly ideological, partly because it's just the way things work, Roman has sort of stood as one of the few big independents.
So you think that part of podcasting still needs to exist some way, somehow, for the spirit of podcasting to still be beating, for that heart to be still beating?
I think it'll exist either way. Like, you know, the thing about big companies and corporations is that they tend to leave certain kinds of demographics out, right? And so those demographics will always have the opportunity, more so now than ever before, to build independent businesses. And I think that will always be a dynamic that's there. And that's why we'll probably always see like independent businesses in media in general as well.
That's Nick Kwa. He's the host of the LA Studios podcast about podcasts, Servant of Pod. Find out on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
But a quick heads up, because democracy needs to be heard, tune in tonight for the vice presidential debate. Senator Kamala Harris faces off against Vice President Mike Pence at the University of Utah. We're going to have fact-checking and analysis from NPR's Ari Shapiro and the rest of NPR's politics team. The vice presidential debate tonight at 6, right here on 89.3 KPCC. Take 2 returns tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.